In less than a week, Spokane, Washington will celebrate the 40th anniversary of the World's Fair, also called the Expo, held in its very own Riverfront Park. Over the weeks preceding this anniversary, Expo 74 will be discussed at great length by officials, experts, aficionados, but perhaps what will be missing the most is the voice of the Spokaneite, who attended Expo in its entirety. What was it like attending a globally recognized multicultural event? What did the largest display in the world of international accomplishments and ideas and visions of the future for the coming years mean to a person who grew up in a city that was really just a large-sized small town? To give us some sense of this, we've spoken with two sisters who combined pretty much didn't miss a day of Expo 74.
My name is Maureen Jones, and at
my
the time
Sharon
of Mouse, Expo,
and,
I'm Sharon Mark's sister.
40 years ago,
my much older sister.
I was 15 years old,
Expo,
and there was so much to do down there. And we spent tons of time in the IMAX theater. Tom and I kind of had a competition who could see more. It was the same film. There was never anything different about it, but we kind of had a competition who could watch that IMAX movie more than the other one. And then they had this weird little skit. There was nothing ever different about it, but there was this weird little skit right before, while you were waiting to go in a theater, so we watched this little skit, and then we'd go into the movie and, file in the way we had to do, because you had to file in by row, and then you had to go out the same way. I don't even know how IMAX theaters work now, but that's how that worked. And the movie was called, it was an environmental thing. I don't remember what it was called.
The film was called Man Belongs to the Earth. Its title is taken from a quote misattributed to Chief Seattle. Either he wrote it for a speech 100 years after his death, or it was written for a screenplay in 1971.
I enjoyed it every time I watched it, and I remember there were different times where I felt differently about it, because it did some different kinds of things. Sometimes they were like an airplane flying,
mm-hmm.
and I just loved that feeling, like you were really there in it. It was just really funny. I know there were people who got motion sickness. I always thought that was kind of weird, but I thought it was so cool. You just kind of felt like you were actually flying through these canyons and over the water, or else you were in a car that was just speeding. All you saw was lights, and the car would be turning and turning, and it was pretty cool. And now you're just seeing regular movies.
Mm-hmm.
The screen is still just, ginormous. It's huge. And I don't get the feeling like I did then of, wow, this is giant.
It's commonly thought that the IMAX at Spokane's Expo was the first of its kind. In fact, the first fully functioning and permanent IMAX installation was in a sphered triodetic dome, similar to a geodesic dome, called Cinesphere in Toronto.
The IMAX, one of the things I remember is it was kind of an open-air kind of place, and one of the times I was there, it was cold. And it was kind of windy inside. And the seats were just the most uncomfortable things in the whole world, as I recall. But, I'm all about comfort. And as I recall, the IMAX theater was not really comfortable. Am I wrong about that, Sharon?
No, it wasn't comfortable. I don't think it was meant for comfort necessarily.
No, it's like sitting on concrete blocks, as I recall.
Yeah, probably. It's just concrete.
With no support for your back. I didn't. It wasn't anything I really wanted to go to very often, just because I don't like sitting on cold, hard concrete. And, I thought the movie itself was really great. And all of the experiences, you know, it was the first time in a movie that speakers really came into play with making you feel like you were there, because, you know, you literally feel like your heart was vibrating from some of the sounds. And so I remember being very struck by that. But there were other parts of the fair that I really liked better.
Arguably, one of the most appreciated things by anyone attending was the opening day ceremony. On the morning of May 4th, 1974, over 185,000 people watched on as actor Danny Kaye, who would start alongside Spokane's own Bing Crosby in 1954's White Christmas, but had also been an ambassador for UNICEF. He read the credo for Expo, entitled "This We Believe." This was shortly followed by President Nixon's opening day speech.
At 12 noon on this day, acting in my capacity as President of the United States, it is my high honor and privilege to declare Expo 74 officially open to all the citizens of the world.
And you were.
Richard Nixon was kind of a short guy, too, so. And they didn't have a. As I recall, he was probably standing down maybe, I don't know, maybe down by the river, possibly. I don't even remember. But
yeah.
Maybe somewhere where it was harder to see him anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as I recall, they were planning that event near the clock tower and the. And all the steps near the river. And.
Okay.
But I wasn't able to go, and so but I do recall that, you know, that it was just probably as many people as our downtown for Bloomsday. It was huge.
One of the things that I remember is the U.S. Pavilion. We had that sculpture. They had that sculpture in the middle of the, you know, that cone-shaped thing. I guess it's a nice meeting right now or whatever. Mm-hmm. But they had a sculpture there that was just... I mean, when you talk about environmental anything, you probably would see that more in the U.S. pavilion than you did in the other ones, because they were talking more about their culture. And they had this sculpture that was just kind of stuff. I don't even know how to describe it. It was anything and everything just kind of all looked like it was just kind of all glued together. I mean, chairs, tables, just household items, and it was big. It was tall. It was really big around, and they just had stuff. But it didn't look, I mean, it didn't look like junk. I mean, we all knew that it was a sculpture. But I don't remember anything like looking, I kind of know what you mean. Like, you know, look out of place or look like it, you know, one of these things just doesn't belong, you know, like Sesame Street or something. But
mm-hmm.
Everything was so unique. I don't think anything really stood out as like, wow, that looks really weird. I wonder why they put that there.
Mm-hmm.
That's my recollection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember what struck me was the U.S. Pavilion, because of the cabling and the, and you know, the odd shape of the roof. They had the strips of canvas going down in between each cable. And at the time, that was just, you know, hunky-dory. But when they designed that, they did not take the wind in Spokane into account.
Mm.
So after the fair was over and several seasons had passed, the wind and the weight of the snow and various things started tearing all of this canvas. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon it was just tattered and it just looked terrible. It was a mess. So then there was this big debate, what should we do about it? What should we do? What should we do? Well, what they finally did is just took all the canvas off and left the skeleton. Mm-hmm. And there was some controversy about that, but there's always controversy in Spokane about anything you do. Somebody's not going to like it. And that was no different. There were people that wanted to demolish it and build a conventional roof, and there were people that thought the skeleton looked pretty cool and just light it up and leave it the way it is. There were people that wanted to put new canvas on it and just replace it every few years, which really wouldn't have been practical or cost-effective, probably. But I do remember that at the time, watching it in the wind and seeing that the canvas would move and flap around a little bit, and I'm thinking, boy, that stuff's going to tear. And it did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same thing happened with the butterflies, too. Mm-hmm. They say that on the tour that you can take down there now. They mentioned that.
Yeah. And there was a different colored butterfly at each entrance to the fair. There were many entrances in. And you know, the colored butterflies served as a really good landmark for where you're going to meet. Mm-hmm. Or you know, if you kind of get lost, we came in at the blue butterfly. Let's try to find that. And
if you couldn't remember where you parked, you could always.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. Come in or out.
Mm-hmm. And there were some entrances that were more convenient than others, but those butterflies, I do remember those very vividly. And yeah, they got beat up too. The one thing that did not happen then that would now, is that things did not get vandalized. There was no graffiti. You know, nobody was in there tagging things. People weren't intentionally destroying things just because it was there.
The scope of the World's Fair in 1974 was so huge that it was focused back inwards. In 1964, the World's Fair in Queens, New York, featured the Unisphere, the largest model ever built of the Earth. In Spokane, 10 years later, we would feature a revolutionary photo of the whole Earth. So we go from a series of how big can we grow, or how far can we take ourselves, to a theme of have we grown too large? Can we take better care of where we are now? Expo 74, it covered 100 acres of Spokane, nearly 40 more acres than Seattle's World Fair in 1962, and it was 547 acres less than in New York. Spokane saw 5.2 million visitors to Seattle's 10 million, and to New York's 57 million. The expo is huge, but it was redefining if you were in a town that no one had ever heard of.
One of the things I seem to recall is that there was a beer garden that the Germans had, and that was a really, really popular spot just for people to get off their feet, because tramping around that park, it was a pretty large area, and people got tired, and the beer garden seemed to be one of the big attractions as to a place that you could just sit there and people watch. And that was one of my favorite things to do, is just watch people, because there were not only the fair goers who may be from Spokane, but often were from just about everywhere. So it got you a really big snapshot of a lot of different cultures. But there were the people that had been sent by their countries to work their pavilions. So you could kind of start intermingling a little bit and get to know people from these different areas. Everybody was friendly. Mm. Everybody. I did not run into anybody that, you know, didn't have a big smile on their face and wasn't having a great time. And I think the people that were sent from other countries probably had a better time than even we did, because it was just probably just a blast of freedom that not only from maybe their cultures, but from their parents and from their, you know, just from the humdrum everyday life that everybody has. So this was quite a novelty. And then there were sites that were just plain beautiful. The carousel had been restored, and the carousel was a huge draw. I remember a lot of people from other countries just in awe of that carousel, just because they'd never seen anything like it. I remember the sky ride too, and often wish they'd just left it up because it was pretty fun. And then of course the gondolas over the river, I remember they unfortunately broke down quite a bit and people were stuck, and you know, they hadn't really perfected them. I think they're a lot better now than they used to be, but and they scared me to death. I was never too fond of heights anyway, and at the rate they were breaking down all the time, I didn't really like going on them. But I remember the Canadian Pavilion as being a really friendly, welcoming place too, and they actually spoke your language, so that was kind of a fun place to hang out. And then, but there were also a lot of vendors there who had nothing to do with countries, that they were more just there to sell postcards and film and you know, whatever you might need. And as far as the food, there was, the smells were pretty amazing, because there was Russian food, and there was Indian food, and German food, and American, and you name it. There, it was there. So you could get, you know, something to eat pretty much wherever you turned. There was something you could eat, plus a little, you know, vendors with carts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, always the popcorn and cotton candy. And I still remember that a lot of the people from other countries, including the Trinidad people that played the steel drums, they were fascinated by cotton candy. And you almost always saw one of them carrying cotton candy with them when they were walking around. But they were also very gregarious and would just walk up and start talking to anybody. Mm. And that was one of the most fun things about the fair, is that you know, you never knew who was going to just notice you and speak to you, and you'd have these very unusual conversations.
Well, gosh, I remember when it was a train station, because my mom never went downtown, ever. Maybe once or twice a year. And I remember driving down Trent, and it was just a train station. You can see bums just kind of sitting there. It was just a cruddy part of town. You would never go there. And the fair just completely transformed that whole area. I mean, I couldn't even describe to you what it used to look like. You'd have to see a picture of, in my mind, what I remember it looked like. And I remember one thing that I also really enjoyed at the fair was a sky ride. It was like a chairlift that would take you from one end of the park to the other, which was really nice if you were like really tired and you parked that way, but you were way down at the opposite end. But you could take the sky right across, and that was really cool, because you got this whole aerial view. I mean, it didn't take you up that high, but I meant that you could see the whole grounds as you were on the sky ride passing over. And just thinking of what it used to look like and what it looks like now. You know, when I'm walking down the park now today, because it's beautiful. It really is a very beautiful park. And I don't hardly even think about what it used to look like, because it's just so different. And I go through the clock tower, and then if I have somebody who didn't know what it used to look like my kids or friends or something like that, I'll try to describe to them what it used to look like when it was Trent, not whatever it's called now, Liverpool.
Spokane Falls, whatever. Boulevard.
Spokane Falls Boulevard. It was just so different, and it was a fun place know, something weird was going to happen, or I don't think people worried about it as much back then as they do today anyway, but I don't know, it was just a total transformation of the whole area, and I don't know, caused other areas of Spokane to, you know, that element to move on to a different part. I know sometimes that happens, but I didn't ever spend a lot of time in that part of downtown. When I was in high school, I spent a lot of time downtown, but never there. I never would have gone down to that part. But anyway, it was just a totally different place.
Mm-hmm. Skid Road. It was the low-income, low-rent neighborhood of downtown Spokane, and it sat across from Havermeyle Island, and it was demolished completely. Apartments and living areas of the poor of Spokane, over 50% of which were senior citizens, and it was replaced with the park that is down there now, the site for Expo 74. This process is called gentrification. In the case of Spokane, it's sometimes called greenification because of the greening or the bettering of the environment, but at the cost of the low-income class. The effect on this class of people, these people that were removed from their homes, it was a butterfly effect, essentially, as they were pushed from where they did live to closer places where they could still afford to live in the downtown area, until eventually they were pushed completely out of the downtown area because of the success of Expo 74.
Well, everybody each pavilion did their own environmental thing, you know, because they had to keep in tune with the theme. I do remember the garbage goat was a huge draw, and everywhere you went, there was some kind of a tape recording playing. Talking about various environmental things, you know, of air, water, and using alternative forms of transportation, bicycling, that was a big part of it. But you know, really, most people that were there were too busy having a good time. Because if it had just been all that environment, and they just concentrated just on that, it could have gotten very dry and not a whole lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of going to something like this is to experience, is the experience. Mm-hmm. And the environment was, you know, that was the theme. It was probably the first and last environmentally themed fair there ever was. And it was a perfect setting because it was right on the Spokane River, and which looked like it was really clean and pristine. It was anything but. But I think the city fathers like to kind of pass it off as if it really were. Now we know that you don't want to eat fish out of that river. Mm-hmm. And because of all the mining in Idaho and all the stuff coming down the river from the mines.
Coal is power. And under the ground, we've got lots of it. The coal lies under the surface in seams that run for miles. And to get it out, miles of the country have to be gouged open. Not long ago, we used to leave it that way. And the scars in Appalachia will still be there for our great-grandchildren to wonder at.
We shared a song of Expo everywhere.
I always loved Spokane, and I always liked the way they made the downtown look. Like I say, I wasn't you know, too up on the politics. I just didn't care about that stuff. So I don't know if there was ever any controversy, anybody who didn't want any of that to happen. There may have been, but I don't recall. It just seems like it was just a really good thing for the city, and I think it's remained a really good thing for the city. When you were talking about, you know, it was had kind of more of a feel for, you know, getting along with each other and that kind of a thing. I do remember the Upper People Group. Maureen, do you remember them?
Oh, yes. Upper People.
Yeah, the Upper People. And they had a little building. I think it was near the Canadian building. Island. And they had a little building so you could listen to the Upper People singers. And they would sing that Upper People song, and I don't know how many there were. Probably a whole column of them. And they would do that they would have shows all day long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm just sick of it. It seems to be like listening to, you know, It's a Small World.
Mm-hmm.
Only it's up with people.
Yeah.
Really enjoying having some place to go every day. I mean, you know, it costs us 15 cents to take the bus downtown for an entire day's worth of entertainment where you didn't have to spend any money down there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was awesome, and you could feel safe, and you, I don't know. I had a very, very positive experience with it. And, you know, as a Spokane I now, I'm just very proud of that whole area. And I tell people, you know, there's so many people that I know who live west of the mountain like I do now, and they never even set foot out of their own hometown that they grew up in over here. Never mind travel across the state. And I tell them, you should go sometime. Just go. And just go to the park.
Yeah.
You know, you can make a weekend out of it and just do that. And I think it really it revitalized the city.
It definitely cleaned up that really miserably dumpy area. I remember when I was in high school, I would take the bus to school every day. I'd just go down to the corner of Longfellow and Addison and get on the bus and drive right all the way downtown. The bus would take you right past that train station. And it was just such a dump. The street was in bad shape. It was dirty. It was just depressing to go by there. And then there were a couple of X-rated movie theaters there. They didn't, in that area, I still remember the El Rey Theater was one of them. And you know, those were the things that disappeared. That kind of a seedy element. It was a very seedy part of town. And it really was completely transformed. And I think really we'd be remiss in not mentioning the suspension bridges over the river that got built too, that you could, you know, turning Howard Street into a pedestrian bridge and the smaller suspension bridges, that just gives you a whole different view of the river and, you know, something we had never, you know, the river was just something you drove over to get downtown on usually on Washington, and there was a really steep bridge going over it, and you kind of peek and your car would almost take air as you went down the other side, and the House of Charity was right there, so that was also an area you didn't walk around in. There were lots of alcoholics and there was a lot of poverty in that area, so it really did change that part of town, completely transformed it, like Sharon said, but those bridges really were a gift to the city, and I was just really glad that the visionary people who wanted to do this kept the good fight up and got it done, because there was so much opposition to it that, you know, there were times that they'd say, it's dead. It's a dead idea. It's not going to happen. And then a few weeks later, somebody would come back with a better idea, and they kept fighting for it till they got it. And I was very proud of that, in that finally there was some progress, and the naysayers didn't get their way for a change.
Yes. Krishna. Krishna was very different to him. Thank you, son. Thank you for your light. Come again tomorrow. Have mercy on us human beings. That was my dad's way of thanking nature. We thank them.